At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama was trying to restore the public's confidence in the economy today. His audience asked that the president be given some special guidance.
We pray for our Commander-in-Chief, President Barack Obama. The decisions before him are great, and they are many.
Today on the program, the president's latest economic sermon from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the end of June 2010 today. That puts us halfway through the year and one step closer to the fall elections. It also helps explain President Obama's road trip today. On the heels of yesterday's worrisome report on consumer confidence, the president made his way to Racine, Wisconsin this morning. Unemployment rate 14%, thanks mostly to a loss of manufacturing jobs. The president's pitch went like this, that the economy is definitely on the mend, but he knows the recovery isn't reaching a lot of Americans fast enough. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more now on the administration's economic game plan.
Today's Wisconsin event began with an appeal to a higher authority, an opening prayer. Then Mr. Obama took the stage with reassurances that echoed those he's been offering since he took office, that reversing years of bad policy won't happen overnight.
The truth is, from the day we walked into the White House, we knew that the crisis we faced was so severe that it was going to take months and maybe even years to fully heal, to dig ourselves out of one of the worst recessions in our history.
Some economists say Mr. Obama's words aren't working. Alan Meltzer is a professor of political economy at Carnegie Mellon University.
Businessmen, consumers want to hear answers, and they're not getting those answers. They're getting rhetoric complaining about how bad it was when he took over. Well, that was 18 months ago. It's his problem now, and he needs to do much better than he's been doing.
Meltzer says the administration needs to give the public a clear plan to control spending and encourage businesses to invest in jobs. At the University of Maryland, economist Peter Morici says the country's trade imbalance is another unresolved problem that's stifling the recovery.
The reality is President Obama is continuing many of the Bush policies that created the mess, appeasing the banks, appeasing China, and at the same time imposing costly new programs that bust the budget.
Morici says it's Obama's problem now and he needs a new message.
You know, if somebody breaks your car, but a mechanic promises to fix it and he doesn't fix it, at some point he's got to perform.
Morici says the public is growing suspicious and it's long past time for the president to back up his words with action. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The talk on Capitol Hill today, other than that small matter of Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan, was AIG and how it went so wrong, so fast, and took so much taxpayer money with it. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is holding hearings trying to sort things out, who did what to whom. That is also the subject of a big article on AIG in the New York Times today, written by Louise Story. Louise, good to have you with us again.
Good to be here.
Before we get to the essence of your piece, there is a little bit of background about AIG and the bailout that we need to make people familiar with. Give us like the 30-second version of that.
AIG, that giant insurance company, wrote a number of large multi-billion dollar contracts to banks tied to mortgage securities. When the mortgage market melted down, AIG was bailed out by the government. A lot of the money in the bailout then went to the bank. So it's been a very controversial bailout.
And speaking of controversy, that's kind of the nub of your piece today in the paper, that as part of this entire arrangement with Goldman Sachs and the government and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, AIG gave up its right to sue over any of these assets that it was insuring, right?
That's right. You know, you thought you knew everything on this bailout because there's been so much coverage. But my colleague Gretchen Morgenson and I dug through 250,000 pages of documents. And what we found was this legal waiver that no one's talked about, in which AIG waived its right to sue on most of those mortgage bonds that the banks had it underwrite. The reason this is important, of course, is because, you know, this spring, the SEC filed a suit against Goldman Sachs involving a mortgage security that's similar to a lot of the ones that AIG insured. And so you've got a lot of AIG executives and shareholders and people out there wondering if AIG might be able to sue, and this waiver that was done very secretly does hurt that possibility.
So one has to ask, why in the world would AIG agree to this waiver?
Well, AIG was really a beggar at that time. They needed the bailout. They were in a liquidity crisis. And if they wanted the money from the Fed and the Treasury, they essentially had to do what the Fed and the Treasury wanted them to do. And this was language that was put in the Fed documents related to the bailout.
It's worth pointing out that the banks, Goldman Sachs in particular, were paid back 100 cents on the dollar, were paid back in full for these deals that AIG had with them, thanks to the government bailout.
That's right. And at the time, some Fed governors in private emails wrote that they felt like they were giving the banks a gift. The banks are paid 100 cents on the dollar. So not only did they get this legal waiver, they got full value on these deals from the government. It's hard to know what was on the mind of the Fed. They would not comment. But certainly there are people, including the Congressional Research Service, who have said this was really a bailout of the banks, not AIG.
Where does it go from here, then? If AIG can't sue over these mortgage bank securities that became toxic assets, what happens to the bailout?
There are about $14 billion of securities out of the $76 billion or so that AIG still could sue on. Or maybe they'll just pay the taxpayer back through their earnings. It's not clear yet whether the taxpayer will recover all of this money from AIG or not.
Louise Story from The New York Times. She writes today about AIG and the bailout. Louise, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Wall Street was rolling right along today, minding its own business, till about an hour before the close. Then somebody hit the sell button. Hit it hard, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is, believe it or not, a new front in the diaper wars. It used to be all about absorbency, soaking up the mess and keeping things neat and tidy as possible, right? Pretty much everybody in the diaper business has that covered by now, so there's a new angle, fashion, in diapers. I suppose it's never too early to start thinking about how you look now, is it? Marketplace's Eve Trow reports.
When it's a number two, I look like number one.
That's Huggies' ad for its limited edition blue jeans diapers, printed to look like real denim. They cost about 40% more than regular Huggies. They've been selling out online at Walmart and Target. Today, Pampers announced its new designer diapers in plaid, stripes, and ruffles. They'll be sold exclusively at Target.
Something kind of quirky and special for your baby. Something to talk about with other moms.
Amy Colton is with Current Marketing. She says diapers have always been printed with teddy bears or rainbows, you know, kid stuff.
And it was really more about them. This is more about mom, to have a little more fun and infuse a little fashion into their mominess.
She says designer disposables extend the trend of Gucci diaper bags and Burberry strollers. And she says it's no coincidence they're out in time for hot weather, making it fashionable for babies to run around with their pants off. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
We've got our BlackBerries and iPhones buzzing with emails from the office. Our laptops are packed with work projects, and our iPods are full of our favorite podcast, there is no escaping this beeping and ringing state of being. Or is there? That's the gist of William Powers' new book, Hamlet's Blackberry. Bill, it's great to have you here.
Thank you, Kai.
Yeah, you know, I would love to have, some fancy smartphone, an iPhone or an Android or a Blackberry or whatever, but I know myself, and I would be down in it all the time if I had one of those things. I would never get anything else done.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm finding, too, in my life is, you know, the more connected a device is, the more addictive it is, the more stuff it's bringing to me, the more I want to be staring at it all the time. And I think it's become, you know, an enormous challenge, not just in our personal lives, but at work. People at work who are missing crucial emails that could have made all the difference in their business because they were focused on too many gadgets at the same time.
Is there an answer then? Because, I mean, you can't not be connected.
No, you can't not be connected. This is the future. This is where we're going to live. You know, our business lives, much of our personal lives are going to be conducted on these things. And I think it has enormous promise. We've already seen that. But I think we have to learn to organize it a little better and be smarter about how we use the devices.
You know, picking up on that line you mentioned about this is the future, it's also the past, right? I mean, you've dug out some examples where this whole information overload thing is not new.
I sort of don't trust futurists. We tend to look to the futurists to tell us how we're going to live with a new technology, and they are so often wrong that I decided to take a sort of different approach and look at the past. And I go back to 7 points in history when some new technology came along that really filled the world with new information all of a sudden, like today.
Tell me about Seneca and the ancient Romans.
Yeah, Seneca was a very powerful Roman statesman, arguably the most powerful man in the Roman Empire for 5 to 7 years. And he was also a philosopher. And he did a lot of writing on the side. And he found himself so overconnected that he had to develop these strategies to get away from the crowd by himself and just have some sustained thoughts.
Well, do tell, man, because we all need those rituals.
Right. Well, he did 2 things. One thing was he found that if he was in a very crowded situation in busy Rome, he could really clear his mind by sitting down with a letter and writing a letter to one person. And he developed the same strategy with ideas. He would try to take one idea a day and set aside some time to focus on that one idea and sort of work it through.
You actually give yourself just 5 digital days a week, right?
That's right. In my family, we do something that we call the Internet Sabbath, which has no religious meaning. It's completely secular. But on Friday night, we unplug the household modem, which serves my computer, my wife's, and our 12-year-old son's. And it's unplugged every weekend until Monday morning.
Oh, I think that would kill me.
It killed us in the beginning. It was very, very hard. But the months went by, and it's amazing how when you get into a regular ritual like that and you really know why you're doing it, after a while, it not only sank in that we could do this, but it actually became incredibly appealing and effortless.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to run this one by my wife, see what she has to say about it. But, you know, I mean, the companies do this too, right? You point out that Intel actually gives its workers some non-screen time.
Yes. What they've done is they've tried all kinds of rituals, no email Fridays, quiet time, all kinds of experiments in trying to figure out how to solve the problem of overloaded employees and this idea of people being unfocused and distracted in the workplace, which is costing companies billions of dollars across the economy.
William Powers, his new book is called Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Bill, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
If we were forced to come up with just one way to make sense of the financial mess of the past 2 years, it might be addiction, an addiction to profit and risk and a dangerous trade well played. Addiction takes many forms, of course, and as we continue with our summer book series, here's a cautionary tale of success and reckless indulgence that isn't about Wall Street, courtesy of our Friday regular Heidi Moore.
My top book for this summer is Portrait of the Addict as a Young Man by William Clegg. Clegg grew up in a small town, and he didn't attend an Ivy League school. But he was ambitious, and he became a literary agent in the glamorous publishing world of Manhattan. He wanted his success badly, and he came to see his own unlikely rise as an affirmation that the rules don't really matter. So he started smoking crack, and his descent was predictably awful. where he once hosted bright, gregarious parties, he later spends his days in dark apartments, combing dirty carpets for lost lumps of crack. Clegg's story is clearly personal to him. Even so, it's easy to see that the theme of addiction applies to so much in our society, from our reliance on debt to the greed of some on Wall Street. All of it came from our own addiction, not to crack, but to money. Traders talk about this. They call it cocaine brain, a sense of invincibility that they get when they win so often that it becomes impossible to understand the consequences of losing. It's a diseased and addictive kind of thinking, and it drove many of the decisions that led up to the financial crisis. In a way, Clegg was lucky. His addiction was obvious, and it brought him enough misery that he was forced to clean up. There are others, however, whose addictions are more subtle. They'll do anything for money or for social prominence, and Clegg's book somehow makes you think that kicking that kind of addiction might be harder.
Heidi Moore writes for The Big Money when she's not on the radio with us. We would like you to write to us with your summer book reviews and recommendations. We'll put them on our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, immigrant labor as theater.
One woman said, this is a kind of therapy for me because I'm here all day waiting at this Home Depot. And being able to laugh, if just for a second, and forget all my cares is wonderful.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped another 96 points today, nearly 1%, closed at 9,774. The NASDAQ fell 25 points, that is 1.2%, finished at 2,109. The S&P 500 lost 10 points. 1% ended at 1,030. Boeing descended 0.5% today after it agreed to buy defense equipment company Argonne for about $775 million. Argonne skyrocketed 40% on that news. It was a tough day for financials. J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs all withdrew more than 1%. I think that's everybody. Oh, wait, no. Citigroup managed to rise 0.8%. Ford drove up 2% today. Stick with the broadcast. You will soon find out why. Bonds gained. The yield on the 10-year T-note dipped to 2.94%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by MassMutual, offering Save the Game, a financial literacy app for children designed for iPod Touch and iPhone, available on the App Store. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, a House committee explores how to improve kids' nutrition. Looking for work? The Labor Department tells us how many people filed for unemployment benefits this week. And you should take a bite out of crime. PR icon McGruff the Crime Dog turns 30. I'm Cormac O'Connor.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. While General Motors and Chrysler were noisily going broke last year, Ford kept mostly to itself. Didn't need a government bailout because it had piles of cash, borrowed money that it got by mortgaging virtually everything it had, even the famous Blue Oval. That all helped Ford get through one of the worst auto markets ever, but too much debt is never a good thing for a company or its investors. So today, Ford announced it's putting more than $4 billion toward paying what it owes. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Not only is Ford paying down its debt, it's paying most of it ahead of schedule. That'll save the company millions in interest payments. But more important, it's a way for management to show how confident it is. Bill Selesky follows Ford at Argus Research. He says all that debt was making investors nervous.
There was such a hefty debt load the company was covering that if things should go bad, well, basically, if car sales slow down, the company was going to be overburdened.
Selesky says it's also significant that Ford is making the payments in cash, not stock, because it suggests the company thinks the share price will keep going up. During the financial crisis, all the money Ford borrowed helped it. Now the debt may put it at a disadvantage, especially when you compare it to GM and Chrysler, whose debts were mostly erased by their bankruptcies. But on other fronts, Ford's doing very well. Kirk Ludtke follows Ford at CRT Capital Group. He says Ford's making cars people want to buy.
They've launched a number of vehicles recently, very high-volume vehicles that are turning out to be well-received in the marketplace, and that's the single biggest driver of an automaker's profit.
Ford will still owe almost $30 billion, but the company's expected to report strong second-quarter earnings, and it's projecting solid profitability for the rest of the year. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Whether you're driving, flying, taking the train, or staying pretty much local, hopefully you're getting away someplace this summer. The Reich family of Northern California is. Our resident liberal commentator Robert Reich puts his tongue firmly in cheek and offers these thoughts.
Most of our summer vacation will be short weekend trips near home. We're economizing, and we tell ourselves by not using all that fuel for travel, we're helping the environment. One trip will require air travel, though, and apparently the airline is charging extra for carry-on bags and considering additional charges for especially heavy checked baggage. It says the fees are necessary because the extra weight requires additional fuel. Economists would approve. Heavy bags and suitcases add to the costs of carrying us from one place to another. So it's appropriate that overloaded passengers pay extra. Gives us all incentive to lighten up. But even with an extra luggage fee, the price we pay for flying still doesn't come close to the real cost of using all that fuel. And it's not just climate change. Think of what's happening now in the Gulf of Mexico and the Middle East. If we're serious about cutting carbon pollution and reducing our dependence on oil, each of us should be paying a price for travel that reflects the full cost of the fuel we burn. Now, I figure that even by this logic, I'm still a good deal. See, I weigh only 125 pounds. So whatever the pricing system, I should be able to bring on more and heavier luggage than someone who weighs, say, 200 pounds, right? I mean, come to think of it, I also take up less volume. I'm not even 5 feet tall and require almost no legroom. If airlines need more overhead space, I could fit under a lower luggage rack. In fact, my whole carbon footprint is way smaller than average. My oxygen requirements are lower. I emit less carbon dioxide. I think people like me deserve a substantial discount. Even the chairman of BP, a big Swede, seems to agree. A few weeks ago, he said his company cared about small people. Although, granted, his real meaning may have been lost in translation. Hey, wherever you're going this summer, even if you're going nowhere, get some rest and be safe.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Next Wednesday, in his regular spot, conservative David Frum. We would like to hear from you, too. You can write to us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says, wait, what now? Oh, yeah, contact. This is apparently Immigration Week at the White House. President Obama's been meeting with labor leaders and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus the past couple of days, and he's scheduled to give a big immigration policy speech tomorrow. Whatever the political debate about who should be allowed to come into the United States, though, the reality is that millions of undocumented workers are already here, most of them Hispanic. They are an enormous labor pool, day labor in many cases, hanging around home supply stores waiting for work. And their experiences have become fodder for an unusual theater project, plays by day laborers for day laborers. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
At 9 on a Wednesday morning, guys looking for work crowd the job center in a Home Depot parking lot. On this unlikely stage, the actors are sometimes drowned out by noisy trucks. Normally, the actors work as day laborers themselves. But they sacrifice half a day's wages in order to perform with the Teatro Jornalero, or Day Laborer Theater. It tours with new material about four times a year, performing at a dozen local job centers like this one. The skits are packed with lessons. Even before Arizona passed its tough new law, the theater group was educating people about labor laws, immigrant rights, and other issues. One recent skit focused on the census, trying to counter misperceptions of it. The theater group was founded 2 years ago. It gets some money from the Ford Foundation, which pays for an artistic director and bus passes for the performers. But otherwise, actors like 58-year-old Luis Sanchez get paid, well, nothing.
No, we don't make any money. Just to perform is gratifying.
Sometimes the need to find paid work takes precedence. So all the actors understudy each other's roles. Ethan Sawyer is project director for the Day Laborer Theater.
The actors are kind of trained to be able to step in for one another, so that on any given performance day, let's say person X doesn't show up, person Y can sort of go, okay, and step in and learn the role really fast so that the show can go on.
Improvisation is also a crucial skill for a day laborer.
I do everything. I work as an electrician, as a carpenter, and I even take dead animals out from under houses.
That's 33-year-old Chico Paredes Orozco. To get to rehearsals in downtown Los Angeles, he travels by bus 2 hours each way. Like the others, Chico was recruited from a day labor site. He has no formal theater training. Back in Mexico, he was in the Army.
Every person who comes here to the United States, we leave our lives behind. Our future changes overnight. Here, all of our learning and our education is not worth as much.
Before coming to the U.S., Juan José Mangani was a union president and a technician at a telecom company in El Salvador. Now, as the group's artistic director, Mangani is proud to educate new immigrants. And at school performances, they're kids.
We perform for kids and been able to change their perception about how their parents are. You know, a lot of the kids that we performed with, their parents are day laborers. And some of them have said to us, wow, I understand what my parents go through every day now.
That's Ethan Sawyer translating. He says the show gets good reviews from day laborers.
One woman said, this is a kind of therapy for me because I'm here all day waiting at this Home Depot. And being able to laugh, if just for a second, and forget all my cares is wonderful.
For the performers, the theater is rewarding in ways that manual labor is not. Again, Luis Sanchez.
It's been a kind of spiritual therapy for me, and I think for other members too.
Doing jobs no one else wants, day laborers can often feel invisible. You can imagine how rewarding it must feel to finally get some recognition. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a quick word on a new report from the Congressional Budget Office. Contrary to conventional wisdom, the CBO says our debt problems will be just fine over the next 25 or so years, provided Congress does nothing at all, just lets all the laws that are on the books stand. Problem is, the chances of them letting the Bush administration tax cuts, say, actually expire or fixing the alternative minimum tax, those are just about zero. There is a link to the study itself and the blog post from whence this final idea came on our website. It's marketplace.org. It's on my Twitter feed, too, at Kai Rizdahl. Make sure you spell that right. The way you spell this is APM's Marketplace. It's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 96 points, nearly 1%. The NASDAQ off 25 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 slid down 10 points. That is 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, on the front lines of the phone wars.
I might love my Sprint phone, but there's one person in the family that just maybe has to have the iPhone, and so the whole family goes over.
My conversation from the corner office with Sprint CEO Dan Hesse. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.